Chapter 2. The descent into sound. The ride in the black Lincoln Town Car was not merely transit. It was a carefully engineered temporal buffer, a mobile decompression chamber between the sterile tower of glass and the chaotic soup of the city. Outside, Sixth Avenue was boiling under a miserable New York cocktail of sleet, gray exhaust, and the frantic, unregulated physics of gridlock. Inside, the heavy, acoustic-dampening insulation of the cabin provided my required sanctuary. It felt like being inside a very expensive, leather-lined velvet box. I leaned back, resting my head against the cool hide of the seat, letting the rhythmic, low-frequency hum of the V8 engine regulate my heart rate while I mentally organized the polygons of tomorrow's schedule into neat, manageable stacks. "So," I said, keeping my eyes firmly closed to preserve my processing power, "are we going to debrief on the Lehman account over dinner, or are you taking me home to stare at the park and pretend the world doesn't exist for 6 hours?" Carmen was busy checking her reflection in her compact mirror, humming a tune that actively defied the laws of mathematical rhythm, a melody that seemed to change time signatures every 3 bars just to spite me. She snapped the compact shut with a sharp metallic click that sounded uncomfortably like a pistol cocking in the confined space.
"Neither.
We are going to the garden," she announced, a mischievous, predatory light dancing in her dark eyes. My internal protective algorithms instantly began throwing red-letter error codes across my mental dashboard. "Madison Square Garden?
Carmen, I am not in the mood to watch sweaty men defy gravity for sport. I have spreadsheets that need my love and affection. I have data that is lonely."
"VIP tickets," she interrupted, pulling glossy, laminated passes from her purse like a magician revealing the prestige card that ends the show. "Knicks versus Bulls. Courtside, front row, Adam. Consider it a surprise shock therapy for your system. A little high-voltage reality to knock the dust off your processor."
"Carmen, I don't need therapy. I need predictable data and a room where the air doesn't vibrate," I protested, my voice tightening as the car made a turn toward 33rd Street.
"You spend too much time in the silence, Adam," she countered, pointing a manicured French tip at me with the authority of a judge.
"Sometimes you need to scream just to verify you still have a voice. Otherwise, you're just a very expensive statue that knows a lot about interest rates."
"You enjoy torturing me, don't you? You know crowds are massive, unregulated variables. I cannot control 20,000 people. I cannot even control the guy selling lukewarm hot dogs. And believe me, I've tried to negotiate the thermal consistency of his mustard." I turned to her, my hands gesturing with a sudden, frantic energy. "Hell, I can't even control you, and you're supposed to be working for me. I am your boss, Carmen. I have a mahogany desk and a corporate seal. In most civilized societies, the man with the seal gets to decide whether or not he is subjected to a stadium full of screaming strangers."
"That's the point, Your Highness," she whispered, leaning in and deploying the sarcastic, highly restricted nickname to soften the blow. She didn't look like an employee. She looked like a lion tamer who had heard this speech many times before. "Trust me, I've mapped the route with the precision of a diamond heist. I'll get us in without you brushing shoulders with a single unwashed soul. You'll be in a bubble of luxury, I promise. Now, straighten your tie. You're losing your imperial gravity, the biological matrix." True to her word, Carmen navigated the labyrinth of the arena's underbelly with the tactical precision of a 4-star general invading a small, disorganized country. We bypassed the suffocating crush of the general admission crowd, the great unwashed, as she jokingly called them, slipping through a private, very important person entrance reserved for the city's elite, the people who prefer their basketball served with a side of privacy. Carmen walked a few paces in front of me, her heels clicking a confident, aggressive rhythm against the concrete, assuming I was right behind her, tethered to her weight. But I was already falling behind. The bass from the warm-up music wasn't just audible, it was a seismic event. It was a physical force vibrating up through the rubber soles of my Italian shoes, rattling my ribcage like a wooden fence in a hurricane. As we pushed through the heavy double doors that led to the court, the physics of the room broke me. It hit instantly, a physical, crushing wall of sound. The pre-game roar of 20,000 people and the shrieking, distorted feedback of the announcer's microphone were not noises. They were a sheer, unregulated wall of acoustic pressure. It was an atmospheric shockwave that violently fractured the delicate glass of my internal equilibrium. My breath hitched. Instinct, ancient, primal, and entirely un-Wall Street, hijacked my brain. I squeezed my eyes shut and clamped my hands over my ears, pressing until my knuckles turned white, desperate to seal off the hostile world. My body began a slow, panicked, 180-degree pivot as I started walking in tight, erratic circles, a glitch in the loop, trying to find a single quiet spatial coordinate inside my own head. I was a $3,000 suit wrapped around a core of pure, unadulterated terror. At center court, Carmen turned around with a bright public relations smile, ready to gauge my reaction. Her smile vanished when she saw only empty space where a titan of finance should be. She ran back, tracing her steps, her eyes searching the corridor with a growing, frantic terror. Suddenly she saw me, a Wall Street prodigy, the Atlas Lion, spinning in a circle with his hands clamped over his ears like a child lost in a department store. I didn't hear her shout my name. I was drowning in sinusoidal waves of gray noise and the blinding flashes of the stadium lights. She hustled back, physically shoving past a bewildered security guard who looked like he was about to intervene. She grabbed me firmly by the waist, throwing her gravity against mine to anchor my spinning geometry. She didn't try to reason with a crashed operating system. She didn't ask if I was okay. She steered me sharply to the right, kicked open an unmarked door, a janitor's closet filled with mops, industrial-strength floor wax, and the smell of ammonia, shoved us both inside, and slammed the heavy door shut. The roar of the arena was instantly decapitated. I stood gasping among mop buckets and industrial drums as adrenaline aftershocks rattled my bones. In the darkness, Carmen moved into my golden circle, that 6-inch perimeter of sacred personal space. She reached up and placed her hands gently over mine, peeling them away from my ears with a firm, steady pressure. She slid her palms to my cheeks, framing my face, and pulled my forehead down until it rested firmly against hers. A gentle grip. "Adam," she whispered, her voice a narrow, trusted frequency cutting through the residual gray noise. "I am here. I am the signal. The rest is just noise. It is okay. Open your eyes, Badawi." I forced my eyelids open. Her eyes were huge, luminous pools of concern, wet with unspilled tears. It hit me then. The gentle grip. It was the exact ritual my mother used to deploy in the Marrakesh Riyadh when the world became too heavy for my young mind to carry. It was the silent transmission of a message. "I am here, and I hear your internal noise." Carmen was flawlessly, perhaps instinctively, channeling that same ancient maternal Moroccan code. Cutting through the sharp chemical smell of industrial floor wax was her specific scent, that elegant architectural perfume of jasmine, warm amber, and musk. It filled my lungs, anchoring me back to the physical world. The code rebooted. The Atlas Lion came back online. I straightened my tie, the mask of the financial genius sliding smoothly back into place, hiding the trembling boy who had just been spinning in the dark. The silence of the closet was absolute. A velvet vacuum that allowed my pulse to decelerate from a frantic staccato to a rhythmic hum. Carmen didn't move. Her thumbs continued their slow, rhythmic tracing on my cheekbones, her touch the only thing keeping me from drifting back into the gray noise. She was searching my face, her eyes still luminous with that terrifying, unspilled wetness. To her, I wasn't a titan. I was a system failure she had to manually reboot. "Adam," she whispered, her voice thick and fragile. "We're leaving. We don't have to do this. The Jumbotron doesn't need to see you, and the Knicks will lose just as effectively without your supervision. Let's just go. The car is still in the tunnel. I'll have Stanley take us straight up to Central Park West. You can be in your own chair, in your own silence, in 20 minutes. I'll find a radio station that only plays static and cello solos for the ride up. No one will ever know we were even here. Please." "I am fine, Carmen," I said, though the words felt brittle in my throat. "Don't be a hero, Adam. Not tonight," she countered, her grip tightening, her forehead still pressed against mine. "You've spent the last 14 hours calculating the trajectory of global wealth. You don't have to spend the next 3 hours calculating the velocity of an orange ball just to prove to these people that you're normal. It's a janitor's closet. We can just stay here until the world quietens down, and then we go home. No one is keeping score." I looked down at her, seeing the genuine ache in her expression. Then, My gaze drifted to the glossy VIP passes peeking out of her purse, the physical evidence of the political bloodbath she had navigated to secure them. Carmen hadn't just reserved these seats. She had likely engaged in a high-stakes game of corporate chess with three different managing directors and a legendary hedge fund shark who regarded those courtside spots as his birthright. She had traded favors, leveraged secrets, and exerted more strategic pressure than a military coup, just to ensure I was seen in the right place at the right time. She had fought a war for this evening, and she was currently prepared to surrender all of it, to retreat to CPW and spend her night watching me breathe, just because I couldn't handle a loudspeaker. I reached up, gently taking her wrists and lowering her hands from my face. I gave her a small, dry smile, the first sign that my processor was back online. "No," I said, my voice finally finding its flat, sovereign register. "We stay. The baseline is established, and I am calibrated. Besides, I refuse to let your extensive campaign of administrative blackmail go to waste. I know you had to practically threaten the life of a junior partner's firstborn to get these passes. It would be statistically disrespectful to your tactical genius to let her victory vanish into a mop bucket." Carmen didn't laugh, but she let out a long, shuddering breath, her shoulders finally dropping an inch. She wiped a stray tear with the back of her hand, her professional mask beginning to stitch itself back together, though her eyes remained guarded. "You're sure?" she asked, her voice still hovering in that private frequency. "Because if you start spinning again, I'm taking out the security guard and we're hijacking the Lincoln." "I am certain," I replied, straightening my cuffs and feeling the familiar imperial mask of the Atlas Lion slide back into place. "Lead the way, Carmen. But stay close. If a mascot approaches me, I cannot be held responsible for the diplomatic incident that follows. The MC and Rose physics lesson." We reached our courtside seats, directly next to tennis legend John McEnroe. John looked like he was in the middle of a private war with the referees, even though the game hadn't reached its peak intensity yet. In the fourth quarter, a heavy, anticipatory silence blanketed the garden before a critical Allen Houston free throw. Needing a logical interface to mask the internal static of the crowd's breathing, I leaned toward McEnroe, whose eyes were locked on the rim with the intensity of a man about to dispute a line call from 1984. "John," I whispered, my voice cutting through the stillness. "The mechanics here are fundamentally flawed." McEnroe froze, a half-eaten soft pretzel hovering inches from his mouth like a suspended asteroid. He cut a side eye toward me that could have peeled paint off a locker room door. "He's a 90% shooter, pal. He's a machine. Just let him breathe." "It's not the shooting," I continued, my voice a deadpan monotone that suggested I was discussing the weather rather than a high-stakes game. "It's the observation. You have 20,000 people projecting a high-velocity dopamine requirement onto a leather sphere. According to the observer effect in quantum mechanics, by observing the ball this intensely, we're essentially collapsing its wave function. Statistically, we are all currently sabotaging his muscle memory with our collective anxiety. We are making the rim smaller just by looking at it." McEnroe turned his head slowly, squinting at me as if I were a talking glitch in the Matrix, part genius, part lunatic. A bewildered, raspy grin broke across his famous weathered face. "Kid?" John rasped, pointing the mustard-stained pretzel at me. "I've spent 40 years screaming at umpires about things that actually happened, and that is officially the most out-there thing I've ever heard. It's a basketball game, not a laboratory at MIT. Just pray the damn ball goes in the hole and stop worrying about the molecules." Before I could explain that prayer possessed no verifiable mechanism for correcting quantum decoherence, and that the ball was actually a collection of vibrating strings, Carmen moved in. She had spotted the massive Jumbotron camera locking onto our row like a heat-seeking missile. "Don't mind him, John," she beamed, her laugh radiating perfect power couple energy for the lens. She draped a grounding hand over my shoulder, pulling me back to the three-dimensional world. "The Atlas Lion here is trying to use physics to explain why he's nervous. Adam, stop overanalyzing the ball and just watch the men run." The nickname clicked. McEnroe's eyes widened as he recognized me from the various Manhattan gala circuits where I usually stood in corners looking brooding. He let out a loud, barking laugh that drew the attention of the surrounding rows. "Adam, Badawi, right, I should have known," John chuckled, leaning back and shaking his head. "Only you could make a Knicks game feel like a Harvard final exam. Stick to the suits, kid. The science is going to give us both a stroke before the buzzer." The game ended in victory, though the statistical probability of the final shot had been distressingly low. As we moved toward the Lincoln, waiting at the private very important person exit, the cold, sharp winter air hitting my face like a slap of reality, Carmen leaned toward me. "Did you see that? We were on the big screen for 3 whole seconds," she said, her tone shifting from the gentle grip of the closet to one of absolute, strategic triumph. "Tomorrow, Wall Street will be talking about our presence more than the closing numbers. You looked like a king, Adam. A slightly confused king, but a king nonetheless." Then, as the chauffeur opened the heavy car door and the sanctuary of the leather cabin beckoned, her voice dropped back into its private protective frequency, carrying a lingering edge of warning. "And now? Enjoy this victory, Adam," she said softly, her eyes meeting mine. "Because your appointment with Dr. Hoffman tomorrow morning won't be this easy. He doesn't care about your wave functions, and he definitely doesn't accept soft pretzels as an excuse for your blood pressure.